Today we declare independence from neoconservatism. We declare independence from neoliberalism, from libertarianism, from what they call classical liberalism. You can give it any name you want, but that set of ideas that sees the atomic individual, the free and equal individual, as the only thing that an educated person needs to know about politics, and if he or she knows the free and equal individual, then he or she has the ability to set out and rule the world. That worldview, we are declaring independence from it today.
That was Yoram Hazony, author of The Virtue of Nationalism, declaring independence from the tyranny of libertarian individualism at the National Conservatism Conference held in Washington, D.C. last week, which also featured former libertarianish figures turned conservative nationalists Peter Thiel and Tucker Carlson. It is Monday morning, and I'm Zach Weissmuller, subbing for Matt Welch on the Reason Editor's Roundtable podcast. Today, I'm joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Eric Bohm. Good morning, fellas.
Thanks.
Morning.
Happy Monday, everyone.
You all have talked a lot on this podcast about the increasing hostility we've seen on the right towards libertarian ideas, but I think it's worth touching on again because of this National Conservatism Conference that drew some big names. We already mentioned Tucker Carlson and Peter Thiel. Senator Josh Hawley from Missouri was also there. The overall sentiment seems to have been summed up by that clip at the top, that they want to separate themselves from the idea that, quote, the individual is the only thing that matters in politics. What is your reaction to that, Nick?
It was like a real Arkham's asylum there. They were bringing in some pretty heavy hitters to talk about this stuff. I love the phrase atomic individual, and I think I might get a tattoo of that.
That's like the Incredible Hulk, right? That's
yeah,
Bruce Banner.
So the Marvel Extended Universe is not over yet, actually. But there's a couple things to say about it. And the first is that this brand of national conservatism, or what's being branded as such, is awful. It is truly awful, and it represents a complete failure by conservatives, in my estimation, to actually win every culture war battle that they have engaged in, and to win every policy battle that they engage in. Because the rhetoric of these people at the same time has always been the idea of limited government and, you know, to reduce the size, scale, and scope and spending of government. They had that opportunity in the early 21st century and failed. What they did instead was they massively increased spending, and they massively increased, you know, all kinds of interventions throughout the economy. Now they're saying, well, you know, that isn't conservatism, and what we want is the worst of all possible worlds, where we are economically kind of liberal and socially conservative. That is a vision of America that has no place to go other than to Tucker Carlson's TV show. It is wildly unpopular and will continue to be. So there's that problem. And this is what you're seeing. This is the flailing tail end of a beast that is just dead and dying, or it was born without, you know, kind of a fully developed brain, I think. It's a really atavistic reaction to the fact that they cannot win anywhere or win over any new people.
It's funny that you would choose that sort of symbolism of born without a fully developed brain, because this is an attempt to put some sort of intellectual basis or pseudo-intellectual right. basis around Trumpism, which, I mean, Donald Trump has no, he's got no ideology.
Yeah,
right. I mean, I don't want to say he doesn't have a functioning brain, but as a political ideology.
We don't think of him as an intellectual.
There's not a whole lot there, and they're trying to build something around it, and I think that's the perfect image of what this is.
Donald Trump is a very smart and savvy operator, and he's effective too. And, you know, and as I've said, many times on this podcast and in my writing, I'm not against everything that Donald Trump stands for, or rather, I'm not against every policy that he's put into place. But the real thing I want to take, you know, or engage is in that opening statement, the idea that libertarianism or that libertarian ideas are only about, you know, what he calls atomic individuals. It's normally talked about as atomistic individuals, that the only thing that matters in a worldview, if you believe in individual freedom and autonomy, voluntary association, markets, and kind of freedom, all you care about is the individual. All you care about is the ability for you to get yours. That is such a fundamental misreading of a kind of libertarian sensibility, which in fact is specifically a rejection of kind of the autarky that is embedded in things like Marxism and conservatism, the idea that certain households or certain people can do everything for themselves. It's the exact opposite. And when you start looking at the tradition, a classical liberal tradition, including people like Adam Smith, but coming through, you know, the Austrians in the 19th century, as well as people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and whatnot, in the end, it is a philosophy that is predicated upon interdependence and interreliance. And one of the reasons why a libertarian society is a good society and a just and fair society is because we recognize at root bottom, none of us can supply everything that we want. And so you will be engaging with people and you will, of course you will treat them with equal respect and recognize the need to help the least among us. So
one thing that struck me about Hazzoni's statement was that he declared independence from, quote, neoliberalism, neoconservatism, and classical liberalism, whatever you want to call it, close quote, as if those are all somehow the same thing. Even though in many ways they're quite at odds with each other, I was thinking about it. I realized what he's getting at was more explicitly stated by Senator Hawley, who declared in his speech at the same conference that it's time we ended this cosmopolitan experiment. And some people in the media were set off by that word, cosmopolitan. I think what they're trying to do is boil this down to a globalism versus nationalism debate, and everything else is kind of secondary to that. Peter, how much sense does that kind of framing make to you?
I think that is a correct way to encapsulate what Hawley's argument is, but it's a little bit odd, at least for a conference that was led by Hazzoni, who is Israeli. To be against a kind of global worldview. Now, he is an Israeli nationalist in certain ways, right? He sort of wants to define sort of each of these geographic areas and kind of ethnic traditions, cultural traditions. He wants to sort of eat them. He wants to retain their uniqueness and all that. And in some ways, there's even some value in some forms of those ideas. I would actually sort of bring it back to something that our colleague Stephanie Slade wrote. She attended that conference and wrote a really great piece in response to it. And what she argued in the end is that fundamentally what they are against is people making choices that they don't like. And that's like the organizing principle of this conference and of this movement, is that people have choices and Yoram Hazzoni doesn't like some of them. Tucker Carlson doesn't like some of them. Josh Hawley doesn't like some of them. And sometimes he doesn't like them when individuals who are members of the media make them. Sometimes he doesn't like them when corporations, say Google or YouTube or Twitter, make them. But in any case, what they are against is choice, and in particular, economic choice. They've always been against social choice. That has always been a part of the social conservative worldview. But what they are now doing is emphasizing that beyond social and cultural choices, what we really want to do is say there are economic choices that you might want to make, that you are making, that we don't like, and therefore we want to use the force of the government, of the federal government, to discourage or actively prohibit those choices. It's a worldview and an ideology that is based around the idea that they know better than you do about how to make.
And I think Peter's right about that. And I just want to add that I think this veneer of attacking multiculturalism or attacking cosmopolitanism is just sort of ridiculous. I mean, Hawley graduated from Stanford and Yale. This conference was held in a Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. I mean, this is not the place you launch a populist people's revolt. It's not the people who launch a populist people's revolt.
Donald Trump against cosmopolitanism. Is a blue-collar guy.
Absolutely, right?
A man of the people. We've all seen the insides of his apartments, his planes. I mean, everybody, right?
It is like, this fundamental contradiction that's at the center of this whole thing.
Right? If you are a middle-income American, you can really relate to having to be on that dump Air Force One rather than your own private plane.
Right, sure. Having to use the gold toilet in Trump Tower, yeah.
To give these people their due, the point of view that they're representing, and there's a performative contradiction, obviously, in somebody like Josh Hawley worrying about cosmopolitan elites and all of that, and it's disturbing because you know, in this kind of discourse, cosmopolitan is widely understood as, you know, you're one step away from starting to talk about international Zionist banking conspiracies and things like that. That's, you know, that's why this has like a bad odor to it. If you bring it down to the debate between globalists and nationalists, which is these categories are not as clear cut as they seem to be. That is what they're talking about, Zach. And I think you're right to kind of zero in on that. And this is from a libertarian point of view. This is one of the things that we need to, I think, do a better job of. You know, Reason is in the outreach business. Ultimately, we're trying to convince more people to have our point of view because we think our point of view is a better explanation for how the world really works and how to enfranchise more people and empower more people. And I think globalists, you know, people who believe in international trade, people who believe in individual autonomy, people who believe in freer movement of people as well as goods and services across mostly arbitrarily drawn national lines and things like that. We have to sell this not to these guys. These guys are lost cases. I mean, they're dead enders and they're ridiculous and they're wrong about stuff. But we need to explain to people who are buying a story that the reason why the industrial Midwest, which in my entire life, and I'm about to turn 56 years old, Buffalo has never been growing. Why somehow, you know, it's the last two or three years of good, you know, relatively good trade with a country like China is why Buffalo is no longer the jewel of the, you know, of the southern tier of New York. We need to be telling the stories about what are the areas, what are the policies and what are the decisions, what are the mindsets that allow people to flourish and not. These people are reactionaries. They don't care about that. And they're wrong about why places like Buffalo are suffering or Pittsburgh or, you know, or the post-industrial Midwest. And we need to do a better job of explaining why our version of the world is actually better for them.
I think there's just a little bit of a contradiction, maybe even a lot of one, in their hatred towards globalism and their defense of the real America, right? And a lot of the kind of political debate, and we're going to talk about more of this later with regards to Donald Trump versus the Squad, but a lot of the political debate in advance of the 2020 election is starting to shape up as a debate about, well, do you care about America? Do you care? And in many ways, that means, do you care about real Americans who are, when that sort of phrase is and that sort of language is deployed, at least from Trump and the people who sort of support him or are in his broader orbit, as a lot of the nationalists are, what they're talking about are the white European folks who, you know, sort of who they view as kind of the core of American culture, often evangelical, at least religious. But that America came here by crossing borders that they just chose, like they just left their countries, they got up, and that America is comprised of people from a lot of different nations and a lot of different cultures and backgrounds. That America is itself a triumph of globalism, and what they want to do is close that off to new entrants. And as with all sorts of regulation, we've talked about this a zillion times on this podcast about how a huge amount of what Facebook wants to do is write the rules that will govern social media, and that is an attempt to prevent new competitors from coming into the marketplace. That's what's going on with the attacks on the globalism of today, is that the people who got here first want to say, oh, we don't want competitors, we don't want anybody else to have and to be able to do what we have done.
The party seems, this sort of breakaway national conservatives or whatever, it seems to me it's sort of like an old right-wing party in Europe in a small country there that says, no, like these borders have some sort of historical significance and only the people who are inside them are true Hungarians or true Polacks or whatever, and that's kind of what they're trying to do. But to Peter's point, I don't think that works in a massive multicultural country like America, because it's not even accurate to describe them as nationalists. That's the word they want to use or frequently use or people use to describe them. But when Hawley is up here talking about, oh, you know, cosmopolitanism, you know, on the coasts, they're not even nationalists. They're trying to subdivide America. And that's I think inaccurately described as a nationalist movement. So
I agree with that. And I think, you know, the economic, you know, part of this is driven by economics, but not completely. And Tucker Carlson earlier this year had that great rant where he was like, you know, sure, I'll give you that, like, you know, having, you know, relatively free trade means that you can have, you know, more cell phones and more plastic objects, but they don't really add anything real to your life. And I think he's wrong about that. I mean, there's actually a pretty strong case. You know, and you know, this is, I think, from Steve Martin's The Jerk, you know, like you can be, you know, when you can be rich or poor, and regardless of everything else, it's always better to be rich. It's better to have more stuff. But we have been telling, you know, libertarians, not so much, but certainly conservatives and certainly liberals for various political reasons, we have been unspooling these narratives of decline for the common person in America. And it's true that, it, you know, when Republicans talk about the common man in America, they are specifically talking about a kind of non-differentiated white European descendant. They're not really that worried about blacks or Latinos. Latinos are the enemy, you know, without that we need to guard against in all sorts of ways. But you know, when we say things like, or when we allow for stories that are the middle class hasn't gotten a pay raise in 30 or 40 or 50 years, when people like Elizabeth Warren or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton talk about the system being so rigged that, like, you can work hard your entire life and you're never going to get ahead and your kids are going to do worse than you, that everything is out of reach. These are fundamentally false narratives about the social reality of America. And that feeds into the sense of alienation that gives rise to these, you know, both to Trump, but also to these kinds of movements. And it's worth kind of peeling back on that and showing the error of what people are saying is actually going on in a Midwestern, you know, in the heartland of the country, which very few people who are, you know, who are talking about even know, much less live there.
And I think if you stripped away some of those false narratives, and if you were someone who was trying to build a sort of socially conservative, economic conservative movement, in a new nationalist kind of movement. And David French had a series of tweets about this weekend where he was talking about you could sort of imagine a political coalition that is made up of the types of people that have been drawn to this new national conservatism, but it would have to be sort of multiracial, multi-ethnic, because it would have to be based on the fact that, like, black Democrats and white evangelicals are, for example, the two most religious and church-going communities in the United States. So it would have to be more inclusive. And I think he might be right that there could be some sort of a socially conservative, post-racial political coalition that you could build there. This group doesn't seem interested in doing that. And to go back to your initial point, Nick, that's one of the reasons why this is a dead-end movement, because if you're going to just continually draw lines and exclude people, sooner or later, you know, there's no one left in the tent with you. And that seems to be the way this goes.
To complicate things a little bit, where it may not be a dead end movement, or it may be more broadly representative, not in this particular iteration, but in its larger kind of concern or its larger solutions. We've talked about this in various contexts. It is true that broadly across the American political spectrum, there is much more appetite and actually even demand for increased government activity in areas that were once seen as you know, the province of business and individuals. And I think that's also something that, again, from a libertarian point of view, to be discussing more, not ultimately what was the kind of checkbook balance, you know, accounting of the 2008 financial crisis, but when you put together, you know, something like the 9/11 attacks, which on one level, you know, represent a massive government failure to provide security, you know, and also reflect ruinous foreign policy for decades, et cetera, which is not to take anything away from the people who did it and all of that. But from 9/11 to the 2008 financial crisis, at the very least, we have seen an ongoing evacuation of trust and confidence in government. And I've written about this, that actually ends up increasing people's demand for government action and intervention into all aspects of kind of cultural, economic, political life. There is an increased appetite for the government to do more stuff. And that is worrying, because this is taking a particularly stupid right-wing reactionary conservative form. But we're also seeing this in the 2020 Democratic presidential race, you know, where people are falling all over themselves to exit stage left. You know, this is problematic, and we need to. And then you even get people like Peter Thiel, you know, I mean, like and Peter was talking about, like, the tech giants are all calling for government regulation, you know, under the guise of you know, being good corporate citizens, but in fact, it's a power grab. But we really need to be looking at the broad forces that are kind of conjuring an interest in more government at every level and in all ways.
If national conservatism is trying to feed that appetite for more government intervention, but to serve conservative or right-wing interests, then the tech space is, I'd say, an emblematic example of that. And Peter Thiel's speech at this conference caught my attention, where he made a series of, he just listed a series of questions that strongly implied, though didn't offer direct evidence, that Google's AI research project may have been infiltrated by the Chinese government, and that Google has engaged in, quote, seemingly treasonous activity with the Chinese military. And he later went on Fox to restate those questions, which were then actually picked up by President Trump, who said, you know, I'll look into that. What do you make of all this?
So can I actually ask just to sort of twist that little that question just a little bit and open it up to everybody here? Just as the, it seems to me like the Thiel stuff, this argument about Google being a traitor for working with the Chinese military, potentially, or allegedly, I should say, that you combine this with the argument that Trump is now making about Ocasio-Cortez and the rest of the squad in Congress, which is that they don't like America, that they are against the idea of it. Thiel is making, in at least the sort of nominally, a sharper point, which is you are working with a foreign military which could become our adversary, which in some ways already is. So maybe the question I have for everybody, which is one that I don't think libertarians always like, or this, that's not right, that libertarians talk about all that much. What do people owe their country? What is it that you as an American owe America that is different, if anything, than say what you owe France or China or Russia or India or any of those other countries? And maybe the answer is nothing. Maybe the answer is that I'm not sure that that's right. And in particular, when it comes to working specifically with foreign governments and with foreign militaries, I would at least hesitate a long while before saying Thiel didn't have a point if, in fact, Google is aiding the Chinese military in the way that he is suggesting.
I would say first, starting with the specific example and charges and things like that, there's no question that Google at various points, as has Facebook, as has Twitter, they have ceded a certain amount of leverage or power to different countries that they operate in. Google's own employees actually push back against various kinds of collaborations with the Chinese government because they felt that it was contravening, you know, their basic principles of open expression and things like that. So they terminated Project Dragonfly and all of that. Does it make sense to assume that the Chinese military or the Chinese government, just like the United States government, is doing everything it can to infiltrate every kind of technological project that's going on? Of course. So I think we need to separate these two questions in a very clear way. Thiel is a businessman who on some level is an adversary of Google. And he is trying to change the conversation away from how should Facebook be regulated in a way that Facebook might not want, to pushing, you know, the conversation onto, oh, well, you know, Google is really the problem. You know, and if we stay in this long enough, we know that all of the tech giants will be ganging up on Gab and saying, you know, the semi-failed socially conservative platform is the real problem. So I think that's the way to look at that. And what Thiel is doing in his actions here is extremely reminiscent of when other tech giants went and complained to Congress or went to Washington and complained, sometimes before Congress, sometimes just before cameras, about how Microsoft had too much market power in the late 90s. And, you know, the government really needed to do something about it. We're not saying break them up, but maybe you should break them up, or at least, you know, just kind of like make them pay a lot in fines. So I think that's one question. The larger question that you're asking, though, Peter, is really fascinating, because there's no question that what America was founded upon is dissent. And dissent and free expression. And I think, you know, when I think about this kind of stuff, I think of America as a robust kind of, you know, it's a temporary autonomous zone that has been around for a couple of hundred years and is doing strong. And it is the ultimate kind of discussion pit where you go in. It is absolutely kind of dedicated upon and built upon a marketplace of ideas where you can say and do basically anything. And I find Ilhan Omar's comments, like, or the attitude that she displays towards America in many of her public utterances, to be so distinct and opposite from mine. The last thing that I would want to do, because I feel like America is actually an experiment that is not ultimately about different people coming and living here. It's an experiment of the mind, where we say we're going to have free and open expression of individual difference, intellectually, emotionally, and things like that. That's, to me, that's what I'm dedicated to when I think about America. And I realize that may be too abstract. But for me, that's where your question leads me.
I mean, to me, I think that's basically right. It's that America is, it's not a people, it's an intellectual idea. It's founded on principles. And one of those principles is dissent. But even more than that, just sort of the right and ability to speak your mind, whether that's in support of something or whether that's in a way that's quite critical. And so, it seems to me that our duty is to uphold those founding ideals and to make sure that they can be preserved, and that those are specifically American ideals that helped us flourish. But at the same time, I think it's a question that it's obviously just going to be a big part of our politics for the next year and a half. And it is a question that libertarians and other people who are being accused, wrongly,
right?
I think wrongly of being unable to care about their countries and what makes them good, it's a question that we should be willing forthrightly to answer.
I agree, but also let's not get trapped into a false thing of like because this is exactly where it goes. America, love it or leave it. And Donald Trump actually has been saying, a kind of version of that for a long time. I mean, that's what that started this whole news cycle. It is not complicated, I think, either in a kind of physiological way and much less an intellectual way. For me, I think about this a lot because, all of my grandparents were immigrants. My parents were the first generation born here in the 20s. It is a huge influence on the way that I think about America and the way I conceive of all of everything about me, including my politics and ideology. And it is simply not complicated to say, I'm proud, or proud, let me put it this way. I'm ambivalent about being from New Jersey. I'm proud to be an American and ambivalent about that. I am a citizen of the world, and I have these overlapping, incomplete, important identities. And it's not very difficult to say, when I read, when I read about Chinese dissidents being, killed, that troubles me because I am a globalist and I believe in universal human rights. I have certain beliefs that come in at the national level or at the local level or at, where I am in any given moment. And then you have all other kinds of, intersectional identities that define you. And I think a lot of the nationalists,
objectively for intersectionality. Yeah.
I am an atomic individual and a massive intersectionalist. I'm a libertarian intersectionalist without apology.
I think
it's not complicated. And what nationalists and what reactionaries want to do, and this is on the left as well, because Ilhan Omar is also saying a version of what Donald Trump, when Donald Trump says, like, go back to your shithole country, he's saying America, love it or leave it. And many times Ilhan Omar is just saying, like, America, hate it and change it. I mean, they're trying to reduce a very complicated but easily understood series of identities into a slogan where, and George Bush, W. Bush got attacked for this, and it was right because it was Manichaean after 9/11 when he said, you're either with us or against us. And it's this attempt to straitjacket people into 100% agreement. Shut up and go along. And that's the enemy, I think, to an American sensibility.
Yeah, only a Sith speaks in absolutes. But just real quick to go back to Peter's point and sort of that started this discussion, I think it's a really interesting and difficult question to answer philosophically. What do you owe your country? But the political way that question is being deployed right now, I think it's important to point out, is being deployed unfairly, I think, and maybe not unfairly, but it's certainly being deployed in a twisted way. I mean, go back to President Trump's inaugural address, right, where he talked about American carnage. He frequently talks about the problems in this country country and the problems that America has. He frequently postures that, America was in decline or was collapsing. The military had been completely eroded away under Obama or whatever. It's all nonsense. But he criticizes America all the time. He and his supporters believe they're allowed to criticize America, but everyone else must stand for the national anthem, cannot even utter, the smallest of complaints about police brutality or about the way we engage in our foreign policy or about the way in which maybe immigrants and minorities are treated in this country by the institutions of the country itself, by the state. That is immediately labeled as unpatriotic and anti-American. And so this question is being really, at least in the political context, it's being asked in a very cynical, twisted way. And I think that sort of gets, I hate to like continually be making this point of this like contradiction in this new right-wing movement we're seeing, but I think it's pretty obvious when it comes to this question of like who's patriotic or not.
That question was grappled with, I would say, yesterday in an interview with the president's senior advisor, Stephen Miller, that he gave to Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, where he was grilling him about this exact question, saying, why is Trump allowed to make comments that are critical of America, but the squad are anti-American while making comments that are also critical? And we have that clip, so let's play it. And I'd like to hear your reactions to Miller's response.
But why is what those congresswomen have said in general any worse than what you just heard Donald Trump say? President Obama is ignorant. This country is killers. On and on.
It's a great question. So I want to drill down on it because it's really the heart of the debate that we're having in this country right now. Anybody who's running for office, right, left, or center, always points out where they think America can do better, where they think America needs to go. But there's a fundamental distinction between people who think that we need to lean into and strengthen America's core values, whether it be our constitutional values, the rule of law, the principles of Western civilization, or people who think that we basically need to turn America into Venezuela. For example,
wait a minute. The fact of the matter is that people can have a legitimate difference of opinion about policies, whether we want to go one way, we want to go another. Under the Constitution that you so believe in, and I believe in, the First Amendment allows everybody to say it. We're not talking about constitutional rights. The president said that President Obama has been the most ignorant president in our history. When asked about Putin, he said, there are a lot of killers. You think our country is so innocent? That isn't, his view. That's being sharply critical of the United States, as critical as the four members of the squad have been.
Right. What I'm saying is there's a canyon-sized difference between saying that we need to have better enforcement of our immigration laws to protect U.S. citizens, that we need to have better trade deals to end the deindustrialization.
That isn't what I'm talking about.
Yes, it is, because the president ran a campaign that could be summarized in two words, America first.
Okay, and just to add a little bit more context to that, the president just about an hour ago tweeted this out. He's heightening the tension and drawing attention to this debate. He clearly likes it. He said, the squad is a very racist group of troublemakers who are young and experienced and not very smart. They're pulling the once great Democrat Party far left and were against humanitarian aid at the border and are now against ICE and Homeland Security. So bad for our country.
Note here, the word racist is capitalized, like, so you can get the full Trump effect. Democratic Party, right, like, border, the border is capitalized. You can always, right, there's a decoding of Trump's bizarre capitalization in which you can tell which important words
the
are.
The Democrat Party, I mean, the kind of feint towards always calling the Democrat Party as opposed to the Democratic Party. It goes back to Joseph McCarthy. And it's kind of wonderful to see how all of these kind of tropes and side slams have been kind of, written into scripts that people don't even understand they're participating in anymore. I think
it really is like Trump is just an amalgamation of like the last 70 years of like the worst parts of American politics.
But
now,
What? Like
maybe not the worst, but the weirdest.
I was going to say, and speaking up in not quite in defense of Trump, but like if you take seriously the idea that he is mostly an effect, not a cause of where we are, I think that's also true of the squad. What I want to focus on in that exchange between Chris Wallace and Stephen Miller, though, is that Miller he immediately goes from, if you question anything that the president says, if you have any serious or even trivial differences with him on opinion or attitude, you are actively pushing, trying to make America into Venezuela. And that is such a bad faith argument. And you see this on both sides. And that is actually the engine that has been driving us into a world in which, and, you know, again, from a small L libertarian point of view, a decentralist point of view, I'm not uncomfortable with it, but this is why Republicans and Democrats do so poorly overall, because they are fundamentally engaged in a bunch of fake debates about, you know, where they are insisting they're coalitions that were built to represent a different set of American concerns from 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that no longer pertain or obtain, but we're supposed to act as if they do. And then they get really pissy when you're like, you know, Republicans, when you fucking talk about limiting the size, scope, and spending of government, but you want to bomb every Arab country in the world, and you want to like shred a bunch of individual rights in the name of national security, and now you want to like put trade tariffs on everything and stop people from coming here and make their lives better, and you're not moving fast against the drug war. I don't get it. Like, I'm not with you. Or on the Democratic side, where it's like, well, you know, because Medicare for all, you know, Medicare is already bankrupting the government. It's only fair if we give it to everybody. And if we have some kind of fucking government institution involved in every possible transaction that we make on any given day. And you're saying that's, you know, that's where we need to go as a country. I don't get that. Fewer and fewer of us are seeing this, but it's that bad faith argumentation, I think, on the part of these parties, because they are desperate and they are dying and they know that. That is really the core of the problem with political discourse in America. And to see Miller, you know, go immediately for, if you're not with Trump, you're for Venezuela. That encapsulates everything. And I do think on the, you know, Trump is in the large part right about the squad. They are young, they are uninformed, and they're not very smart. And that's not a bad thing. And I'm happy to have that kind of conversation as well.
I will say that to the extent that they are not particularly smart about politics, it's no more so than Donald Trump himself, yeah, who is also deeply inexperienced
about
policy,
really.
But that's true of Ocasio-Cortez, who has really, in many ways, pulled from a sort of an inverted young person's version of the Trump,
yep,
social media, rile them up, you know, sort of keep them
They're the perfect foils. You read Hollywood screenplay books.
Right. No, that's it. Right. You complete me. It's you read Hollywood screenplay books and the villain is always supposed to be the inverse of the main character. And if you can't figure out who the villain is in the first 25 minutes, it's the character who is exactly like the protagonist, except perfectly opposite. And that's, in this case, that is Ocasio-Cortez. And it's not an accident that Trump picked her as his as the opponent that he really wants to run against. She's not running for president, but he is making her an avatar of the Democratic Party and of the left. I obviously have huge, huge substantive policy disagreements with her. I'm not quite sure it's fair to say she's not real smart. Yes, she is inexperienced, but so is Donald
Trump.
They're
both savvy political operators, in the same way that Trump is a savvy political operator who has figured out how to win in this sort of new age of social media driven news and of politics that is, you know, it's just sort of a fire hose of political thought and punditry and commentary without any real policy.
Absolutely.
Substance.
They have literally both waved away, you know, the idea that expertise or being right about facts matters. I mean, they don't care about policy substance. It is about the gesture and everything. And it is worth focusing on for a little bit, because Trump, in a lot of ways, is, you know, he's a worst case scenario, I think, for a kind of American profile. And he is president, which is different than being a freshman Congress, you know, a member of Congress.
It can
from
always
Brooklyn.
Get worse.
Yeah.
Nick.
Thank you. You know, in many ways, but they are so similar in the sense that they don't know what they're talking about. And they don't care that they don't know what they're talking about. But the Green New Deal, which, you know, the Green New Deal is as bad a kind of vague set of proposals as has come down the pike in decades in American politics. And I don't think it's going to ultimately represent where the Democratic Party goes in the 2020 election and things like that. But to the extent that it exerts an influence, it's going to be a bad influence.
The core of Miller's answer there was, it's okay when Trump does it because he's standing up for Western civilization and putting America first. And to bring it back to the conference we were discussing at the beginning, That seemed to be the underlying message of the conference. We're putting America first. And the, one of the things they all seem to agree on is a way to do that is by battling against free trade, embracing tariffs to protect the American worker. And Trump supporters point to an increase in manufacturing jobs under Trump as evidence that that's actually working and that we need more of it. Eric, you write a lot about trade policy. So could you give us your evaluation of the current state of the trade war and the claim that tariffs are helping American workers?
Yeah. To take the first part of that first, the current state of the trade war actually is that it seems to be in a bit of a lull at the moment, which is relatively good news. The president lifted the tariffs on aluminum and steel from Canada and Mexico, and there hasn't been an escalation in tariffs on China, which were at one point planned, but then the administration postponed them. There's also sort of the threat of maybe tariffs on imported cars hanging in the background. There's the chance we could have another escalation in the near future, but at the moment, things are somewhat silent. I think to make this whole conversation we've had today sort of have a theme, there really is this tension between these two claims that the president and his supporters tend to make about manufacturing jobs in particular. I think on one hand, they want you to believe that American manufacturing has been gutted or destroyed by either outsourcing to China or Mexico or whoever sort of the villain du jour is, that these other countries are taking advantage of us and that because of that, these extraordinary measures are needed like tariffs. On the other hand, they want you to believe, and the president said this last Monday when he had this Made in America PR stunt on the White House lawn, and he said that there's been an extraordinary resurgence of American manufacturing since he took office. And there's part of both of those claims that are true, but I think they're both really overstating things, and I think the connection there is not as clear as the president's supporters want you to think. It is. So I think the first thing you got to do here, and I promise I'll be quick with the numbers part of this. You look at the numbers of manufacturing jobs in the United States. They peaked in 1979, just under 20 million manufacturing jobs. By March of 2010, we were at a post-war low of 11.4 million. So about half of all manufacturing jobs were lost. That was right at the end of the Great Recession. Now, that decline started and really accelerated long before NAFTA. Most of it happened in the 80s, long before China emerged on the global market. The experts who study this say that it's not really so much about jobs moving overseas where labor is cheaper, but really it has to do more with automation than anything else, that we can just make more stuff now with fewer people, and so there are fewer manufacturing jobs. And this is actually a good thing. It means we get cheaper goods. It frees up labor capital for other pursuits, all of that. And then there's the second part of this is to look at the recovery. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are 12.8 million manufacturing jobs in the U.S. right now as of June. So that's a gain of 1.4 million since that low point in March of 2010. About 500,000 of that 1.4 have come during Trump's tenure. I don't think it's fair to call that an extraordinary resurgence. That resurgence started during the Obama years. It was largely then sort of accelerated a bit by the tax cuts in 2017. Trump does deserve credit for that. But the key part of this and the thing that I wrote about last week is there's a new report from A.T. Kearney, which is a consulting firm. They do this annual report looking at the reshoring of jobs, offshoring and reshoring of jobs. And they find that there's almost no evidence that tariffs are bringing jobs back to this country. If anything, shifting in manufacturing out of China because of the tariffs are taking jobs to India and Vietnam and Mexico, not back to the United States. So just to put a cap on all this, there was a long, decades-long decline in American manufacturing. We've now seen about a decade-long, slow, gradual recovery in American manufacturing jobs. That's great and should be applauded, but it's not an extraordinary resurgence, and it's not due to the president's tariff policies. It's due to things largely beyond the president's control.
And if we keep going down this path, abandoning the idea of free trade, which you can see the momentum both on right and left towards that, towards getting out of free trade agreements, what do you expect is going to happen in the, I guess, medium term, Eric?
I don't want to monopolize the conversation, so I'd love to hear from Nick and Peter on that, too. But I think I think this is just going to be part of our politics. I mean, there's obviously on both the right and the left, there is a strong incentive to oppose. I think it would be really easy for Democrats to attack Trump for his tariffs. There's lots of great sort of individual stories of businesses. There's a steel plant, for example, just outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that is currently in the process of laying off about 100 workers entirely, they say, due to tariffs. The problem here is, and the other sort of tension, is that the economy continues to do really well overall, and that really blunts any of these specific criticisms, either general criticisms of the tariffs, like, hey, they haven't worked because they're not bringing jobs back to the United States at all, or specific criticisms where you can say, look at this plant here in Pittsburgh. Look at a steel fabrication plant in Ohio that's lost 50 jobs. You know, there are these sort of individual cases, and there's also a broader case to be made against tariffs. But as long as the economy is doing well, which I don't wish for the economy to not do well, it's going to be difficult for Democrats to attack the president on that ground, even if they wanted to. And I don't think a lot of them really want to, because I think on the left, there's also sort of, there always has been this sort of resentment of free trade agreements or of lowering barriers to trade with Mexico and China. So this is something that I think libertarians in particular, and sort of the cast-offs of the right who are not part of this national conservatism movement, I think we have a difficult argument to make, but I think a very important argument to make about the benefits of free trade, and about how even if it's not necessarily the most obvious thing happening in the economy, that there are costs to the president's trade policies, and that those costs there's not really any commensurate benefits on the other side.
And if the economy tanked, you know exactly what would happen.
Ooh, man.
Which is,
yeah,
Trump would say, well, now we need tariffs more than ever.
I really worry about
to protect the American economy, which is struggling. It would be, he's making the argument that they're causing the economy to be strong. And if the economy wasn't strong, he would make the argument that they're necessary to make to restore it to what it was whenever it was, you know, the first 2 years, and that we need them more aggressively. It would be there would not be a situation, an economic story, an economic narrative that would not result in Trump concluding that the tariffs are the solution.
Well, and that's where he's at already, right? He says that that American manufacturing was completely depleted before he took off. And you heard Stephen Miller talking about, you know, the fact that they need to have the sort of these tariffs and build up the American build up the manufacturing economy. That's obviously not true. The data doesn't support that. But that's already the message that's out there. And I really worry with populism being such a strong force in politics at the moment, if we did have a recession in the next year or so, that's something that like sort of actively
and
terrifies me.
What is what's additionally terrifying or at least frustrating is that it seems pretty clear that a lot of Democrats and partisans on the left are pretty much hoping for a recession because
that's how they get into office.
It would be good for Democrats politically, yep, especially if it happened in the first 6 months of next year. Elizabeth Warren just this morning released a big argument saying that there's a systemic risk to the economy and that we're probably on the verge of a collapse. Now, I think it's actually, you know, we're in the longest boom, basically, in, you know, sort of in post-war and recorded history, and booms don't last forever. It could be that that the growth phase that we are in now ends sometime before the 2020 election. So I don't want to rule that out. But there's a lot of kind of nasty and cynical politicking going around this.
I do want to turn to the Democrats quickly before we wrap up with our cultural consumption. But on the left, Nick mentioned earlier, we have proposals like the Green New Deal. The Democrats' version of putting America first seems to be kind of massive new domestic programs, Elizabeth Warren in particular. And last week, Reason TV put out a video featuring Peter that was thoroughly dissecting Warren's so-called ultra-millionaire tax, which is supposed to pay for all those plans. For instance, single-payer health care, free college, debt relief, child care. And it's going to do it by taxing the savings of very rich people. And I recommend everyone watch the video or read your article, Peter, to understand why the math there doesn't quite work out. But I'm wondering, Peter, as you survey the political landscape, who do you see among the viable national candidates taking the idea of actually doing the math and paying for new spending or balancing the budget seriously?
No one. Elizabeth Warren is in some ways coming closest because she's pretending to have plans. And everybody else is just not bothering to have them at all. Elizabeth Warren's plans don't add up in many ways. And, you know, so the two biggest problems with the wealth tax are, or two of the biggest problems, maybe not the two biggest, are that if you look at the experience in other countries, it tends not to raise nearly as much revenue as expected. Not to say that it raises $0, but some countries, but that is why many of the dozen or so OECD countries countries that had wealth taxes in the early 1990s have gotten rid of them. Today, there are only three or four, depending on how you count. And when they have gotten rid of those taxes, there has typically been no significant effect on the budget. So it's probably not going to raise the amount of money that people say. And even if it does, even if you get the couple of $1 trillion that Elizabeth Warren is projecting from them, she's double dipping, triple dipping into that pot of money and using it and applying it to pay for more than it would raise according to her own estimates. And so it's a sort of it's a cover. It's a pretense. It's a pretend plan. And it's not really about raising revenue. It's just about saying that I think that very rich people should have less. It's a wealth tax rather than a tax on moving money around. And so it just sort of hits the same pot of money every year, right? If you have more than $50 million, you get hit with this 2% tax. And it just taxes your wealth every single year. If you have more than $1 billion, there's a surtax on that, and it taxes your wealth every single year rather than taxing you for doing something. It is taxing you for being something. And that's an important distinction, and it is really, it's best understood as a sort of partisan positioning. It's a populist message that says, I just don't really like very rich people.
I want to open the question of debt up a little bit more to everyone to weigh in on, because I just want to know how we get people to take the idea that debt actually matters seriously. It seems like there's a movement, it's popular to just kind of say that debt in a sense isn't real when it's government debt. It can always be there and you can always add more to it and it'll just sort of take care of itself. And that's kind of on the best case scenario. On the worst case, you get demonized for caring about the debt. You're more concerned about this abstract number than real people suffering. And we saw that to some degree last week with Rand Paul. The hashtag Rand Paul Hates America was trending on Twitter after he delayed a vote on a program which would have paid out benefits to 9/11 first responders, because he wanted to add an amendment that got into the details of how you would pay for this decades-long program. And regardless of whether Rand Paul was right or not to take a stand on that particular issue, is there a sensible strategy to make people understand that debt does matter?
No, there is not.
There you've got again the hating of America sort of framing again, which has been a theme of our conversation here today, that, you know, oh, Rand Paul has some legitimate points to make about really the biggest crisis facing this country, which is the debt crisis. And if he can't break through in talking about that any other way, he's going to try to break through to make a point about it by holding up the 9/11 victims bill. And then what? He gets that's just, oh, well, Rand Paul hates America. Let's not have a serious discussion about the debt. Let's just castigate Rand for doing this and say that he's against America. And we don't then we avoid having to actually face the reality of $22 trillion in debt.
I think that the fundamental problem here is that the people who care about debt, first of all, are not really represented in Congress in either side of the party, because the Republicans, you know, it's very important to understand, and Peter has written often and eloquently about this, in the early part of the 21st century, Republicans had full control of the government, and they said, we don't give a fuck about debt. And as a matter of fact, we're even going to spend wildly and hide much of our spending through kind of emergency appropriations and supplemental spending that helped fund wars that were unpopular and completely badly run, et cetera. But they do not care. And you go back to, I think it was in 2003, when Dick Cheney famously said, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. And after that, the deluge, because there was no serious way that the Republicans could, you know, when they wanted to hold Obama or the Democrats accountable for spending too much, they were just rank hypocrites, and everybody knows that. I think the most important argument against debt and against the accumulation, not of some debt, but of massive, incalculable debt like we have now, is that it really affects economic growth. And there's a reason why we've been in the longest expansion in economic history and U.S. economic history, but it's also been the slowest and the lowest. And part of that is because of debt overhang, as economists talk about it. And this is something that literally you know, free market economists as far to the right as possible, the most libertarian market, laissez-faire oriented people, all the way to, so there are Marxist economists at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst agree that having massive loads of national debt retards economic growth over time. And that that's, it's a hard conversation to have, because what you're talking about is not no growth, but significantly lower growth over time, which compounds. And this is the difference between having a good lifestyle and having a great lifestyle with, you know, personal jetpacks. It's difficult to talk about, and it only gets dealt with usually in crises. It does not get talked about when, you know, people have other things to talk about.
Well, let's put off talking about it anymore right now and close out by talking about our cultural consumption this week. You know, what are you watching, reading, or playing? I can briefly say that I just belatedly finished the final season of HBO's Veep, which I was a huge fan of. I actually made a recent TV video about how great it is. Its explanatory power in terms of dramatizing the idea of public choice played up for comedic effect. You know, it shows politicians, it demystifies politicians, making them neither evil geniuses nor heroic statesmen. It's more of an in-between, just regular people making self-interested choices. And it had a couple of rough seasons lately, but I think that they got it together for this final season. And it's been fascinating to watch in general the way that Hollywood portrayals of politics have evolved and adapted post-Trump. And I think Veep kind of captured the right dark dystopia and yet giving it a comedic edge in the final season.
I think it had a more successful final season than Game of Thrones, and it was kind of annoying. I like you, Zach, I was a big fan of Veep, and it was kind of frustrating to see its finale get overshadowed, because I think it pulled that series really holds up well as a total unit, and it goes all the way to the end. The finale is extremely satisfying.
I agree. So what about you, Nick? What are you watching or reading?
I have been, for a variety of reasons, and partly it's because of all of this discussion of, you know, dissent, kind of a talking back to power comes in and out of fashion in American politics, depending on what side you're on. When George W. Bush was president, the left was all about praising dissent, and there were all these anthologies of historic, you know, cases of dissent and texts and posters and all of that. Then when Obama got into power, and Zach, I remember this is years ago, but you did a great video about after Obama was elected, like whatever happened to the anti-war movement. And it was like, oh, well, they became, you know, fundraisers for Obama because, you know, yeah, he was persecuting or prosecuting all the wars just as bad and just as badly, and in many cases in much worse ways. But, you know, the anti-war left.
Yeah, they never really came back either. Yeah.
Yeah, the anti-war left was like, well, they were actually secret Obama voters, so they didn't give a shit once he was in power. But in any case, as a result of the, you know, the kind, and just over the past couple of weeks, we've been talking a lot about, like, you know, are you, you know, how do you change things in America? What is America? And that brought me back to the great political economist Albert O. Hirschman, who in 1970 wrote a book called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, which is about strategies to how do you deal with firms, states, and organizations that are in decline? What are the ways that you respond to that as an individual or as a group within that? And he posits that. And so I've been reading Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, which is a short book, but is absolutely just fantastic in talking about, you know, how do you change things in organizations that are either in decline or in great conflict? And along with that, I also am reading a shorter collection of his called The Essential Hirschman. And it's all Hirschman is essential. He's just a political economist of incredible insight who talks about organizations, talks about things like the firm or the state, as well as individual responses within those. But then he also talks a lot about how do we know if a kind of social scientific theory makes sense or not. Is it a just so story, or is it actually giving us some kind of penetrative analysis? And Albert O. Hirschman, start with Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, but read anything you can by him. He's also a really sharp stylist. So that's what I'm up to.
That's great. Peter, what about you?
I have started watching the Amazon original series Homecoming, which stars Julia Roberts and is directed and overseen by Sam Esmail, who, if you know Mr. Robot, he was the showrunner, sort of creator of that show. It is a military thriller with perhaps some mild science fiction elements to it. So I'm only a little bit of the ways in. And it really, I think, shows what you can do with some of these new, with a bunch of different new media formats and with the amount of investment in original fictional content and storytelling, not just in television these days or in streaming, but it actually started as a podcast and was the premier podcast. And it's fictional. It's a radio drama, you know, of the kind that we haven't really seen in a lot of years. But it started as a podcast starring Catherine Keener and then was, it was part of this company that has received like $200 million or something in investment called Gimlet Media that is really like a big, in a lot of ways, a large podcast startup that is trying to do innovative things. And now it has become a show with Julia Roberts. Sam Esmail's direction is so fascinating. He is just such an interesting sort of visualist and student of camera movements. And, you know, I also on an airplane over the weekend watched The Mortal Engines, which is a big budget kind of CG mess of a movie that came out a year or so ago. And just watching it, it just seemed so lazy and slapdash the way it was directed. And that movie had so many resources. And yet it just sort of, I mean, and it's visually kind of interesting here and there because the art department is good, but it's not well directed. It's not made by somebody who really seems to have a purpose and intention with every shot. And that's the thing with Esmail's direction and with Homecoming. It's well written, it's well acted, but it's just so fascinating to look at as a visual artifact because he is so careful and methodical in the way he moves his camera around and the way he lights his scenes, in the way that every object is perfectly staged and chosen. And seeing that come out of the podcast world and kind of the harmony between streaming new media, from Amazon on the one hand, and a podcast company that has been either invested in or bought by Spotify on the other, and the ways that those are sort of creating new opportunities for auteurist directors like Esmail to work outside of what we think of the traditional Hollywood feature system is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's an exciting future, and I'll definitely check that out. I love Mr. Robot. Eric, what are you watching or reading these days?
Just a quick note on Homecoming. It's really good, and the coolest thing about it is the format, that it's a half-hour serialized drama, which is a thing you never see on TV. All these shows that are anything like that are always hour-long.
You never see an hour-long comedy.
It's so well taught.
Or an hour-long animated show, and dramas are always an hour. And so changing up, just like some basic things, like we're going to change the length of a
and
drama.
And it's so taut as a result of that that it really works well. I don't like the ending. I won't spoil it. I know Peter hasn't seen
apparently
it yet, but
I'm not. There
it's
is
a little bit disappointing.
There is a season two in development,
so
perhaps it has not fully ended.
I want to register a small note of sadness when podcasts migrate back into TV, even if it's streaming and all of that. It seems to me...
Maybe we'll have TV shows
you know, this
podcasts.
Is Marshall McLuhan right. famously said that every new, kind of every new format or every new medium spends its first generation or two replicating that which it has just supplanted. And I feel a little bit sad about that.
Yeah. I'll just wrap this up real quick. I just finished watching the third season of Stranger Things. I was a little bit disappointed by the writing in that, which seemed looser and sort of flabbier than the first two seasons. And really, it really makes me appreciate just how well written the first season is as like an homage to 80s tropes, but also to 80s story writing conventions, rather than now that it just sort of seems like a pastiche of 80s nostalgia. Secondly, to end on a very light note, I am reading, or just finished reading, Dave Barry's new book, Lessons from Lucy. He was a guest on our podcast here a few weeks ago with Catherine Mangu Ward, and it's just like a love letter to his dog, but also a sort of occasionally deep reminiscence about his own life and about getting older and things like that. That is really like the perfect beach read. I was sitting on a beach in Nick's home state of New Jersey 2 weeks ago and enjoying that 2 weekends ago. Really, really good summer read. And one of the best convergences in the book is the revelation that I didn't know before, that Dave Barry had been in a band with Warren Zevon. And that just makes such perfect sense, yeah. Right? Warren Zevon's maybe my favorite songwriter of all time. And like the wittiness and the sort of introspection that they both have, and cynicism towards politics and culture in general is really, like, that just makes such perfect sense in my mind. So Lessons from Lucy.
Okay. Well, this was fun. Thank you all for joining me. Your regularly scheduled host will be back in this seat on Monday. Thank you for listening. This has been the Reason Podcast. You can find us on Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud. So please subscribe. Have a great week. Thanks for listening.